From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the rabbi who launched the current debate on the meaning of the Book of Genesis, Burton Vysotsky. His Genesis seminars at the Jewish Theological Seminary were described in the New York Times as the best conversations in New York City. They also inspired Bill Moyer's current PBS series on Genesis. Rabbi Vysotsky is one of the participants. We'll talk about his approach to reading and interpreting the Bible. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Fire authorities in Southern California are hoping for help from the weather today. Wildfires have destroyed 130 homes and burned at least 35,000 acres. Six firefighters have been hurt. One of them is in critical condition. Gusty winds, which have been fanning the flames, died down overnight. Firefighters are planning to drop more water and fire retardant on the flames from the air today. Some 125,000 people are without power in Kansas City, Missouri. A powerful storm dumped several inches of snow on the city. Mary Jo Draper of member station KCUR reports from Kansas City.
The unexpected snowstorm brought up to 8 inches of heavy, wet snow. The biggest problem occurred because many trees in the Kansas City area still have leaves. The snow caused the trees to bend and break, blocking roadways and taking down power lines as they fell. The hardest-hit area was the Kansas suburb of Overland Park, where almost half the residents were still without power this morning. Many area residents were stranded on highways during rush hour last evening, only to find their homes dark when they arrived. The power company says it may be 72 hours before electricity is restored. Although temperatures hovered just above freezing last night, they're expected to reach a high near 55 or 60 today. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Jo Draper in Kansas City.
A cargo plane crashed into a city this morning in Ecuador. The aircraft fell into the downtown sector of the coastal city of Manta. The Boeing 707 clipped a church bell tower before it went down. At least 24 people are dead, including three American crew members. The BBC's Willa Davis reports.
Eyewitness reports said the jet first hit a church as it crashed and then set several surrounding buildings on fire. The emergency services were stretched to the limit as fire crews struggled to bring the flames under control and the main hospital treated dozens of people for serious injuries. An appeal was also sent out to other parts of Ecuador for medical supplies and help in dealing with the tragedy. Authorities said the four-engine jet, which would have been at least 30 years old, was laden with fuel for its journey to Miami. The plane, which belonged to an American-owned company, Millium Air, often flew this route, taking fish products from Ecuador to the United States. Although officials at the town's airport were unable to give any early indication as to what caused the tragedy, on learning of the accident, the Ecuadorian president, Abdallah Bucaram, declared a day of national mourning and said he would visit the scene of the crash as soon as possible.
Willa Davis reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow is off more than 50 points as the market extends yesterday's correction. The selling is led by sales in technology shares. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is currently down more than 58 points at 6,003. Trading's moderate. The Nasdaq is off about a point at 1219. This is NPR. Peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians have resumed in Jerusalem. The Palestinian negotiators are less optimistic than they were earlier this week. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat says both sides must still overcome wide gaps as they try to resolve the Israeli troop withdrawal from the West Bank town of Hebron. It's been reported that Arafat wishes to clinch a deal that would also include an Israeli promise to fulfill the remaining elements of agreements that have already been signed by Israel. The peace talks continue to be moderated by U.S. peace envoy Dennis Ross. The United Nations Refugee Agency says tens of thousands of refugees have arrived at a makeshift camp in eastern Zaire. Meanwhile, Zaire's government is again accusing Rwanda and Burundi of inciting ongoing violence along its border. NPR's Jennifer Ledden reports.
After an emergency cabinet meeting, Zairean officials said up to 2,000 Rwandan and Burundian soldiers had crossed the border to carry out attacks during the past week. Their claim is supported by aid agency sources. Zaire's ill president, Mobutu Sese Seko, also issued a statement from Switzerland urging officials to kick out invaders. Both Rwanda and Burundi deny any involvement. They accuse Zaire of wrongfully expelling and attacking ethnic Tutsis known as Banyamulenge. Amid the violence, some 250,000 Rwandan and Burundian refugees in Zaire are believed to be fleeing the clashes. Rwanda's president yesterday urged the Hutu refugees to return home. He said his Tutsi-led government would make sure no one who returned was mistreated. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Abidjan.
Members of the Canadian auto workers are voting on whether to ratify a deal with General Motors. The agreement could pave the way for a deal between the automaker and the United Auto Workers in the United States. Talks between the UAW and GM resume today in Detroit. They are also thrashing out the thorny issue of outsourcing. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a national conversation underway about the meaning of Genesis. The first book of the Bible even made the cover of this week's Time magazine. The conversation was launched by my guest, Rabbi Burton Vizotsky. Bill Moyer's new PBS series on Genesis was inspired by Vizotsky's Genesis seminars, which were described in the New York Times as the best conversations in New York City. Vizotsky is now one of the participants in Moyer's series. Rabbi Vizotsky is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in Manhattan. He has a new book called The Genesis of Ethics. He told me how he started the Genesis seminar.
In 1986, I started thinking about what I do for a living, Midrash, which is how the rabbis read the Bible and read between the lines. And it struck me that what they do is really an enormous act of chutzpah, real nerve for them to take the gumption to put words in the mouths of biblical characters, even put words in God's mouth. And it struck me if I brought together some writers, fiction writers, essayists, screenwriters, maybe if they read the Bible with me, I might get an idea how the rabbis of old also were able to, as it were, write script for the biblical characters.
So is that why you chose mostly writers of different sorts to be in the seminar?
The original seminar, yes. I really focused on writers. As it turned out, it was a naive choice. I didn't learn much at all about how the rabbis did their thing, but I learned an awful lot about how to read the Bible, perhaps for the first time, without those rosy-colored glasses of rabbinic tradition.
Now, you said that reading the Bible with your group of writers, you started to take off the rose-colored glasses that you'd seen the Bible with or that other rabbis you felt had seen the Bible through. Is there a particular story you can focus on briefly to give us a sense of how the meaning of one of the Genesis stories changed for you through this Genesis seminar?
Well, as I recount in my Genesis of Ethics, Genesis chapter 12, the very first introduction we get to Abraham and Sarah, they are given the call by God to go to a foreign land, which will become the promised land, to Canaan. And when they get there, lo and behold, there's a famine in the land. So Abraham and Sarah go down to Egypt. At the border of Egypt, Abraham suddenly seems to realize that Sarah is a very beautiful woman. And he says to her, listen, they're going to see you and want you, and they'll kill me. So far, so good. Abraham has gone through all of this. But then suddenly he says to Sarah, listen, tell them you're my sister. And in the biblical text, it then says, I suppose we could translate, so it will go well with me, and they will keep me alive on your behalf. Although two lines later, that same phrase, so it will go well with me, is pretty well defined. It went well with Abraham. He got oxen, goats, herds, cattle, sheep, servants. In other words, it sounds an awful lot like Abraham says to Sarah, listen, tell him you're my sister. I'll sell you and make a profit on it, which by my morality is not something we're supposed to do with our wives.
So how did you originally interpret that story and how did the meaning of it change?
Well, I have to say that I have a long history with this passage. When I was a bar mitzvah boy at age 13, that was actually what I read from the Torah. And I always thought it was a sweet narrative about a lovely husband who was concerned about his wife and his family. And at the end of that narrative, Pharaoh rewards him and isn't everything peachy keen. As I got to be an adult, I saw that this was a husband and wife who seemed to have some trouble with one another. They do things that are morally objectionable. And with my writers group, we agonized about this story for quite a bit and finally settled, perhaps unhappily, on what I call the Sophie's Choice defense for Abraham and Sarah. Which is to say, if we had set the same story in a Holocaust setting, we would say, fine, she's one of thousands of women who prostituted herself to save their family, and we consider them righteous. So too Sarah. Of course, as I say this, I'm thinking in my mind, never mind that Sarah doesn't get to say a word in that biblical narrative. So it's somewhat questionable. This was made even starker for me when I read the same story with a group of CEOs and their lawyers and their bankers, and they had a very, very different reading of this Genesis narrative.
What was their reading?
Well, one of the lawyers, a criminal attorney, having read the story and gave me a little bit of room for me to start wringing my hands over the moral dilemma of Abraham apparently prostituting his wife for his own skin. And then at a certain point, he just shut me down. He said, whoa, wait a second. Let's look at this chapter. In the beginning of Genesis chapter 12, God takes this poor schnook, this shepherd, this nothing, and says, I'm going to make you the head of a great nation. And then the lawyer said something that I will always remember because I had filed it in my lawyer joke file. He said, morality aside. And we all kind of giggled. But there it was. Morality aside, he said, by the end of the chapter, let's face it, Abraham's talking one-on-one with the head of state, he meant Pharaoh, and whether you like what he did with Sarah or not, he's earned startup costs. Well, we all laughed, except that I confess, Terry, that I started losing sleep over it because it slowly began to sink into me that maybe this lawyer was the best reader of Genesis I'd encountered. He didn't carry the rosy-colored glasses of religious tradition, whether it's Jewish or Christian. He just read the story as he saw it. He is a criminal attorney. He knows how the world works. And he thought, well, maybe Abraham's getting rewarded. Indeed, maybe Abraham is chosen by God because he has what it takes, morality aside.
So this is like the ultimate pragmatist. You know, he made a practical decision and he profited.
Yes, and it's kind of horrifying to think that this might, in fact, be the morality of Genesis. At that moment, I really understood that it's a very different book than the book we've been reading it as. We read, as it were, as Hellenists, people from the Western world who are imbued with Greco-Roman culture. And yet the Bible is a document of Semitic shepherds, a very, very different world. And that fierce morality, the Israelites are a small, embattled nation, do what it takes, might indeed be the morality of Genesis.
So given how many ways the Bible can be interpreted and how many of those ways you are open to as accepting as interesting interpretations of the Bible, of what use is the Bible to you in terms of guiding you in your life when it's so subject to interpretation, so ambiguous?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. And that question kind of is the one that cuts to the heart of the dilemma. Obviously, the story I just recounted and many of the Abraham cycle stories are stories that are well known to all three Western religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I certainly could not read a lot of the Bible stories as being indicative of the coming of Jesus because I'm not a Christian, nor would I read them as a Muslim would read them. And yet all three faith traditions, to say the least of secularists, find some source of their morality in the Bible. So it's not just a group of people being relative readers, it's three major religions, each reading through their own lenses. And I guess the answer to your question then is, what makes a difference how you read is what community you read with, because you form a community, whether it's a Jewish community, a Christian community, a Muslim community, but you form a community of readers who have certain parameters as to what's kosher and what's not in the way you interpret.
So for you, part of the point of the Bible is to have something to interpret in a community.
Yeah, I think that's really the way it's got to be done. Sitting alone in your room, you can interpret all you want, but it doesn't help you except to make you a little crazy. If you read in community, and that is, as you know, the case in the Muslim, Christian, and Jewish communities that we read publicly, interpretation has some anchor. In the Jewish community, we not only read and argue and debate about the current meaning of Scripture, but we also have a tradition of studying what our ancestors have said so that we connect with literally 2,000 years of interpretation of Scripture.
Let's talk a little bit about the Jewish approach to studying the Bible. You're a professor of Midrash. Explain to us what Midrash means.
I've spent the last 25 years trying to
do that, huh?
Get a short definition. I think it was the physicist Feynman who, when someone asked him to, you know, very briefly explain why he won the Nobel Prize, he said, well, if I could explain it briefly, they wouldn't have given me the Nobel Prize. Midrash is the way the rabbis of old, and I suppose even us moderns, interpret Scripture. You read between the lines. You try and parse out the gaps in the text, the hidden meanings. In other words, Midrash is searching out, and that's literally what the word means, searching out God's will by reading scriptural narrative and scriptural law. So Midrash is a very active, strong reading of the Bible.
So Midrash assumes that there isn't just one meaning. Midrash assumes that the Bible is about varying interpretations, constant reinterpretation.
Very much so. In ancient texts, I'm talking now about texts from the 4th and 5th and 6th century, texts in Hebrew and in Aramaic, the rabbis are fond of saying that there are 70 possible interpretations to any verse of Scripture. Or another rabbi from the 3rd century says that when God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, each of the 600,000 who heard it, each of them heard it in a different voice. This possibility of endless interpretation is also underscored by another rabbinic saying that says, turn it round and round, in it all things can be found. So again and again, the rabbis are open to the fact that the Bible should be the source of all wisdom, which is the nice news. The other side of that coin, though, is that the Bible is subject to radical reinterpretation, and the rabbis always struggle to balance tradition with that change.
You point out in one of your books that the Bible is actually full of contradictions. You know, if you want to go directly to the Bible for wisdom, it's actually full of contradictions. For example, Isaiah says, beat your swords into plowshares, your spears into pruning hooks, and that's absolutely reversed by somebody else later on in the Bible. Would you describe that?
Yeah, the prophet Joel says exactly the opposite. He says, take your pruning hooks and make swords and your plowshares into spears. What my comment on that is that what that kind of proves is if the Bible is the word of God, it's very much time-bound. God can say one thing for one era, in other words, prophesy war, and then for another era, prophesy peace. God's word is condition because it's given to human beings who are certainly less than perfect vehicles for getting the Word of God.
The opening of Genesis describes how in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. Is that something that you have reinterpreted and heard reinterpreted many times over the years that you've been studying the Bible?
Well, you know, that's a very difficult translation even to begin with, and mm-hmm. modern translators don't even say in the beginning anymore. Often translators say, when God began to create the heaven and earth. But that phrase in Hebrew, the very first word of the Torah in Hebrew, has a terrible grammatical difficulty, which has given rise to endless interpretations. Just to give you an idea how picayune rabbinic readers can be, in a 5th or 6th century interpretation of Genesis, they actually divide that word up, and there are a half dozen midrashim, little comments, on the first letter of the first word of the Torah. So the rabbis atomize. They break the words of Scripture into their constituent parts and sometimes into their constituent letters to wring meaning out of as much as they can in the Bible.
So what is the Hebrew opening there?
In Hebrew, it says, Bereshit bara Elohim, which we translate in the beginning, following the Greek translators, but nowadays it's often translated when God began to create. Hard to know exactly where to put your commas. Hard, in fact, to know where to put the vowels in that Hebrew word. Good grammar would have us say bareshit for in the beginning, but that's not what the text says. The Masoretic text, as we've received it, says bereshit. In the beginning of God's creation, something like that, it's a dependent clause and makes for some complicated translating and therefore changes the meaning of the text.
Rabbi Burton Vizotsky will be back with us later in the program. His new book is called The Genesis of Ethics. He's a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in Manhattan. This is Fresh Air. Let me paraphrase what Bill Moyers recently wrote about broadcasting and religion. There's no shortage of talk about religion, but religious conversation in the democratic spirit is rare. We hope you enjoy Fresh Air's ongoing discussion about the world's religions. Before we get back to Rabbi Vizotsky, I need to explain that this is a national fundraising week for public radio. We're taking this break to urge you to call and support Fresh Air and all the programs you've come to rely on. Thanks. This week, we're featuring a series on the history of the blues with our rock historian, Ed Ward. The recordings he's playing are selected from two blues box sets released by the Smithsonian Institution. Today, Ed tells us about the post-World War II era and how the electric guitar changed the blues in Chicago.
World War II radically changed the lives of many African Americans when they discovered that due to manpower shortages, war-related industries were integrated. For the first time, they could work a good job and get paid the same as everyone else. More money meant more to spend on leisure, and although the record industry was mostly shut down due to shellac shortages, the club scenes in Harlem, South Central Los Angeles, Chicago's South Side, and many other neighborhoods were jumping. And since moving to a big city didn't turn you into a sophisticate overnight, a lot of the jump was caused by blues.
Mr. Blues jumped a rabbit and running for one solid mile. Yes, Mr. Blues jumped a rabbit and running for one solid mile. Well, the blues caught the rabbit and he cried like a baby child. He said, please, Mr. Blues, don't treat Mr. Rabbit so bad. Please, Mr. Blues, don't treat Mr. Rabbit so bad. Don't you know this is the first blues that I've ever had?
The blues coming out of the cities in the 1940s were a potent combination of the drive of swing jazz and the earthiness of down-home blues, and shouters like Wynonie Harris packed them in wherever they played. And at war's end, a new spirit of entrepreneurship came to the record industry as hundreds of small labels appeared to record some of the music that had been ignored for so long. As a result, the blues got another lease on life.
Well, I'm drifting and drifting like a ship out on the sea. Well, I'm drifting and drifting like a ship out on the sea. Well, I ain't got nobody in this world to care for me.
Sepia Sinatras like Charles Brown were able to sell thousands of copies of records like Drifting Blues, but they weren't the only blues singers getting a chance. In Detroit, a businessman found a transplant from the Mississippi Delta, recorded him, and watched as the record shot up the charts.
Well, my mama, she didn't love me. She had to stay out all night long. Oh, Lord. Well, my mama didn't lie me. She had to stay out all night long. I didn't care if she didn't lie. I was boogie-woogie in her house.
Finally, Hooker touched black homesickness with Boogie Chillin' and sold hundreds of thousands of copies of it in 1948. Another generation had arrived from the South, and a more aggressive music was coming out of Southside clubs.
Well, I roll and I tumble, cried the whole night long. Well, I roll and I tumble, cried the whole night long. This morning, didn't know right from wrong.
McKinley Morganfield, known as Muddy Waters, was the baddest cat in town, and his electric slide guitar playing updated the music Robert Johnson had played. Robert Johnson had influenced musicians far in excess of the small number of records he'd sold while alive, and it really showed in Chicago. Elmore James made a career out of Johnson's Dust My Broom, recording it countless times over the years and using its slide lick even more. Playing harmonica on the original recording was Alec Rice Miller, who took the name Sonny Boy Williamson after the original Sonny Boy was murdered in 1948, and he too became part of the Chicago firmament.
You're talking about your woman. I'm wish to God, man, that you could see mine. You're talking about your woman. I wish to God that you could see mine. Every time the little girl starts to love me, she brings eyesight to the blind.
And rounding out the pantheon was Chester Burnett, who had traveled with Charlie Patton as a boy and now called himself Howlin' Wolf. Smokestack Lightning, one of his most powerful songs, features his howling, which he claimed was an attempt to imitate country singer Jimmy Rogers. The rivalry between all these musicians could fill a novel, but it resulted in a creative ferment that would echo down through the decades. And as rock and roll started its long gestation, the blues was also mutating in several more directions. More on that tomorrow.
Rock historian Ed Ward, our series on the history of the blues, is produced by Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Rabbi Burton Vizotsky. His Bible seminars inspired Bill Moyers to create his new PBS series on Genesis. ¶¶ This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our conversation with Rabbi Burton Vizatsky. Several years ago, he began a series of study groups on Genesis, the first book of the Bible. Those seminars are the basis of Bill Moyer's current PBS series on Genesis. In fact, now you can see Vizatsky participating in Moyer's series. Rabbi Vizatsky is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan and the author of the new book, The Genesis of Ethics. What do you think of as your job description as a rabbi now?
Well, I have to qualify it a little because I'm not a congregational rabbi. I'm an academic. I'm a professor.
Right.
I teach graduate students and I teach rabbinical students. I would say my job is to study Torah, to read the Bible and its commentaries, and then to teach it, to teach the value of ongoing community, and to try and find ways for people to realize that morals and ethics are important in their lives, even if we're not always perfectly moral and ethical, and I certainly would say I'm not perfect by any means. Nevertheless, we have to struggle to find a way, and while we're at it, it doesn't hurt to find God in our lives.
Since you don't have a congregation, you're a professor, you don't have congregants coming to you asking for advice, and I'm sure a lot of your students come to you asking for advice on their studies. But do your students come to you ever asking for advice on their private lives, on the ethical decisions they have to make
Always.
In their private lives?
For the last 5 years, I just kind of retired. I was the associate dean of the graduate school at the seminary, and one of the things I loved about that job was that I did a lot of student advisement. And yes, obviously, a lot of it was academic. How do I get out of this class or take an incomplete for this class? But a lot of it was boyfriend problems, parent problems, religious problems. One woman came to me who had just had a baby and whose father was dying, and she was just utterly stressed out, but sandwiched between the two, and I immediately had sympathy. Since both of my parents are now gone, I remember what it was like to have parents on their deathbed with small children in the house. And this woman just wanted to drop out of her doctoral program, and I took her sternly in hand and said, no, you can't drop out of your doctoral program, but what you need to do is cut classes for 2 weeks and just go to the museum, go to a movie, give yourself some time. And she survived quite happily because she realized that she had some permission to treat herself well in the midst of trying to treat everyone else in the world well. So sometimes I think that I have the best job in the world. Actually, most of the time I think that because I get to study and teach and be with people all the time.
In a world where there are so many therapists of every sort, do you feel that the rabbis should still be therapists in a way? Rabbis were doing that work before we had the word therapist.
Well, I think rabbis and therapists have somewhat different tasks. I certainly think it is the job of a rabbi or any clergy person to help other people. But therapists can do things I can't, and I can do things that therapists can't, and I think that's as it should be. I don't think any clergy should mistake themselves for someone in the therapeutic profession. Those people are trained differently than we are.
What are some of the differences?
Well, clergy are trained to transmit religious tradition. Now, often that religious tradition speaks to deep human problems, but we are trained to transmit tradition, whereas therapists tend to be much more accepting, much less judgmental. My example in kind would be if someone came to me burdened with having committed adultery, and sometimes I've had that kind of episode, and it's clear to me that what they want is absolution, they might be able to get absolution from a therapist much more readily than they will from their rabbi. So that's a big difference. The therapist may say, that's okay, whatever you do is okay. A rabbi may say, well, if you feel really strongly about this, you might want to think about whether you really need to keep your family together. And if you need to keep your family together, you might not want to consider adultery. Those are very radically different answers to the same circumstance. And I think people need to consider very carefully who they're going to, whether they go to their rabbi or to their therapist, for whatever problems are burdening them and what kind of answers they're looking for.
Well, when somebody comes to you with a question, for instance, about adultery, what might you tell them about consequences?
Well, just in asking the question, give the answer. Everything has consequences. There are lots of people involved, and that you always have to think about the consequences of your actions. That's what it means to be an adult, Terry, is that you know that you can't do things without consequences. So your question is the answer. What do you think about consequences? Once you've raised that question to a person, then they start thinking about consequences. They might behave a little differently.
What about like the notion of sin? Where does that figure into in the Jewish tradition?
Well, sin certainly figures strongly in the Jewish tradition. There's no sense denying that. There are lots of things that are labeled in the Bible very explicitly as sins. I say that, and as I say it, I'm thinking that more often than not, those sins that are labeled in the Bible also have a very explicit prescription for how to atone for those sins, and that is blood sacrifice. Well, we don't do blood sacrifice anymore, which may tell us that the very definition of sin has changed. But in any case, there are an awful lot of sins that people still do that are considered a sin. I remember once having a conversation with Ivan Boesky, of all people. And Ivan said to me that he felt that he had paid his price for his crimes, that he had, you know, paid his fines and gone to jail, but that he still wasn't sure what to do about his sin. And I was so startled that he was talking about sin that I asked him, well, what do you mean by sin? And he said to me, well, I've been thinking about this a long time, and I think that in addition to having done what I did that the government prosecuted me for, I really committed a terrible sin. And that was that I used people as the means to the next transaction. And once he said that, I asked him whether I could quote him on that, because I think that's about as good a late 20th century definition of sin as we could want, to use people as the means to the next transaction. Because in order to do that, you have to forget somehow that they are another person, that they have a life, that they are also in the image of God. And if we could only learn to listen to other people, truly listen to them and get past our own selves to really see them as an other person, then we've come a long way on the sin scale and learn to perhaps do some good in the world and build community.
My guest is Rabbi Burton Vizotsky, author of the new book, The Genesis of Ethics. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rabbi Burton Vizotsky, his seminars on the first book of the Bible inspired Bill Moyer's current PBS series on Genesis. You are the founding rabbi of the Egalitarian Worship Service at the Jewish Theological Seminary.
Yes, that's something I'm very proud of.
Tell me what the Egalitarian Worship Service was and why you thought there was a need for it.
Well, the Jewish Theological Seminary has been around for 110 years now, and only for the last 10 or so of those years have we been ordaining women rabbis. For the first century, it was, although it was middle of the road, it wasn't Orthodox, it wasn't Reform. The synagogue at the seminary was, in fact, an Orthodox synagogue. Men and women sat separately. Men ran the service. Men got called up to the Torah, and women were, at best, observers. When we started ordaining women, we realized we had to redress that problem in some very profound way. And we decided that since we're a pluralist institution, we would now have two synagogues in the seminary. One, the old-fashioned way, and a new one, which was egalitarian. What that meant was that men and women would be treated equally in the synagogue. Women could lead services, women could read from the Torah, and I was proud to be the first rabbi to institute that part of the seminary synagogue.
Was there any resistance to it within the seminary?
There's resistance to all change. There were a lot of people who thought that the ordination of women was the worst thing we could possibly do. There were a lot of people who thought that if we instituted an egalitarian worship service, no one would come. There were equal numbers of people who thought that if we instituted an egalitarian worship service, it would take everybody away from the old style service. The fact of the matter is, to this day, both services are alive and well, and people pray as they see fit under one roof.
Now, how do you justify change to people who really believe that religion is about continuity? It's about a connection to the past. We don't make radical changes. That's not what religion is about.
Well, people do change, and society changes, and our relationship to God changes accordingly. I think you're right that there is continuity to the past. That is what religion's about. And there is, I think, an innate conservatism in a large part of religious practice. We want to do what our ancestors have done. At the same time, if we are utterly static, if we never change, religion dies. It dies without any growth whatsoever. In order for us to speak to the needs of the late 20th century, there have to be some kind of changes. They have to be considered slowly and carefully and in light of tradition. But changes are necessary. People do change, and I'll speak only about my own tradition, Judaism. Judaism has always learned to speak to the current condition of the people as they try to observe the traditional means of things. So there's a lot of tension. There's push-pull there.
When did you realize that you wanted to see a more egalitarian synagogue?
I can almost clock the moment. I used to pray in a synagogue that was very old world. Ironically, it's now in the middle of Harlem, but Harlem was once a vibrant Jewish neighborhood. And I still used to go there, and the rabbi was an old Polish rabbi who still preached in Yiddish. Even when he preached in English, it sounded like he was preaching in Yiddish. So, you know, it had all the flavor of the authentic article. And there was a men's section where men ran the service, so it was very old world. And then there was a women's section. And many years ago, I was almost dragged into the women's section after services. And I realized that I really couldn't see what was going on. And I realized that all of the women who sat up there had been virtually set apart from synagogue life simply by the fact that they were women. And that was the last time I went to that synagogue.
Who dragged you to the women's section?
A woman friend of mine who enjoyed the service but was herself going through this terrible struggle about how can you connect with this and at the same time feel so utterly excluded. This was a woman who was fluent in the ways of Jewish tradition, who lived a traditional Jewish life, who studied the Talmud, and yet could not bear to find herself a second-class citizen.
Would you ever have gone up to the rabbi at the synagogue in Harlem and said, look, rabbi, you have to understand things have changed, and how could you imagine that women would be comfortable with this type of segregation and second-class status?
Well, I did feel I owed him an explanation why I stopped coming to the synagogue, and for better or for worse, he was able, I think, to understand that on my own terms, I couldn't stay there any longer. But he was an old man. He had been a rabbi in Poland before the Nazis invaded, and I wasn't fool enough to think that he would change his ways or see the light. Furthermore, I'm not even sure that it was necessary to dissuade him. What worked for him in his community didn't work for me in my community, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't have a right to do it his way.
I have a question for you. You obviously welcome a certain multicultural approach to interpreting the Bible. You like to have Bible study groups that have people, that often have people of different faiths in them. So you're hearing the Bible from different Christian points of view, Muslim points of view, as well as Jewish points of view. And yet I know that intermarriage is a really big and controversial issue within a lot of the Jewish community. Will intermarriage be the downfall of Judaism? Will people intermarry so much that there won't be any Jewish people left? So given that you kind of embrace multiculturalism, where do you stand on intermarriage? And do you worry that, you know, if Jews don't just keep to themselves, that the religion will die out?
Well, let me almost duck the question by telling you, first and foremost, I'm not a congregational rabbi, so it's not so much a worry in my life. But as an academic, I must tell you that Jewish studies are now utterly vibrant. There have never been so many Jews doing Jewish studies at any point in Jewish history. I think the Jewish community is more vibrant now than it was 25, 30, 40, 50, 100 years ago. In light of that, I don't worry so much about intermarriage. You're right. I think that multiculturalism helps us intellectually learn new things. I mean, what's the point of studying with people who all think the same answer that you have? The point of study is to get a diversity of viewpoints, to sharpen your thinking, to challenge your thinking. And that's why I like not only inter-religious dialogue, but even among Jews. I like studying with Reform Jews. I like studying with Orthodox Jews. I've even learned of late to study with Hasidim and study mysticism. The more, the better, because we have broad-ranging intellects that need to be fed. Whether that translates into tranquility in home life is another story. And for couples who want to be intermarried, I think they have to know in advance that they're going to have a difficult row to hoe trying to figure out how to raise their children, how to celebrate holidays, and find a path for themselves. I don't think I would be quick to dismiss people who are intermarried. The short answer to your question, try once more, is I think if Jews and Christians want to study Bible together, that should only be encouraged. That's hardly something to look askance at. The more Bible study, I think, the happier we are. Our differences will be clear quickly, and the fact that we can learn to listen to one another is a goal that serves not only both religions but our society at large.
But you think it's different in the home?
Well, I think home life has its own dynamic, and it's no secret that people have different behaviors at home than they do in public. And often tensions arise over religious issues that may not arise in the course of, say, Bible study in a public forum.
As we record this interview, you are about to get married. You're getting married in a few days. I'd love to hear what kind of ceremony you're planning.
Well, I'm marrying a Jewish woman from Long Island who is an attorney, and for me, the difficult question is, which rabbi do I ask to perform this ceremony, since virtually all of my friends are rabbis? But I have two dear friends, one of whom I worked with for many years when I was the associate dean of the graduate school at the Jewish Theological Seminary, the other of whom serves both as the rabbi of my synagogue and my Friday morning study partner. And they will be performing the marriage ceremony. It will be a mostly traditional Jewish ceremony, although the very traditional Jewish wedding contract will have a clause in it that's actually added from a 9th century manuscript, which gives the woman pretty much equal rights, which traditional Jewish marriage contracts don't always do.
Are you writing your own vows or anything? What do you think of that?
Jews are always pretty wary of vows, because vows tend to bring God in as an unwilling partner, and vows are too easily broken. But the marriage contract is the essence of it, and the marriage contract, which is in Aramaic, which, as it happens, is a language I know, is really Jewish marriage contracts are anti-nuptial agreements.
Anti-nuptial?
That's with an E.
Oh,
prenuptial agreement.
prenuptial. I thought this is a pretty radical approach to marriage license.
Guaranteeing to the woman, in what used to be a society where women had very little rights, guaranteeing to the woman in case of divorce or the death of her husband that she get a share of the estate. In my marriage contract, not only will I give all of those traditional guarantees to my soon-to-be wife, Sandy, but Sandy will, in her Aramaic portion, guarantee me certain things as well, and together we, I guess the word is vow, but we affirm that we will have a Jewish home where we respect one another and love one another and serve one another equally. And that little clause, feminist though it sounds, is from a 9th century document, a manuscript found in the old synagogue in Cairo.
So that 9th century document assumes the possibility of divorce.
All Jewish marriage contracts assume the possibility of divorce. The Torah itself, in the 5 books of Moses, women are guaranteed the right to a divorce document if their husbands want to leave them, and it's a divorce document that guarantees the women some financial capabilities.
So divorce isn't looked down on?
No, if you're in an unhappy home, I think divorce is a mitzvah. It's a commandment. You don't stay unhappy. You don't stay miserable. You don't torture one another. You don't torture your children. You start over. Human beings are imperfect and frail, and the Torah recognizes that.
Burton Vazotsky, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a wonderful hour.
Rabbi Burton Vazotsky is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan. His new book is called The Genesis of Ethics. You can see him on Bill Moyer's PBS series on Genesis. The series was inspired by Vazotsky's Genesis seminars. This is Fresh Air. On Fresh Air, we spend a lot of time talking about the world's religions. Our ambition is to discuss the subject in a way that is of value to people of many different religions, as well as to those who don't follow a religion but have an intellectual interest in the world's religious traditions. Many listeners have let us know that they appreciate these conversations. During this National Fundraising Week, we hope you'll support our program with a pledge. It's the only way to keep it on the air. In Mona Simpson's new novel, A Regular Guy, a product of the counterculture comes face to face with a new age icon when 10-year-old Jane, who was raised on a commune, suddenly appears at the doorstep of a father she's never known. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says the clash of the child and the computer geek make for fascinating reading.
Sometimes a novel will contain an image so indelible it remains long after the character's names or plot structure has crumbled away. Take, for instance, Evelyn Waugh's A Handful of Dust. I'd surely flunk a multiple-choice exam on that novel, but I've never forgotten its comically chilling penultimate scene in which a British explorer lost in the Amazonian rainforest realizes he's doomed to spend the rest of his life reading aloud the collected works of Dickens to his insane captor. Likewise, I suspect in a few years I won't recall the details of Mona Simpson's new novel, A Regular Guy. But I will remember the extraordinary scene early on in the story where a 10-year-old girl named Jane, who lives on a remote Oregon commune, is taught by her suicidally depressed mother how to drive their old pickup truck. As soon as Jane learns the basics, her mother sends her off in the dead of night with gas money and a package of Fig Newtons to drive over the mountains to live with her father, a man she's never met. With panic lodged in her chest, Jane completes the trip, and Simpson writes, "The most terrible and wondrous experience in Jane's life was over by the time she was 10, before she'd truly mastered the art of riding a bicycle." That opening scene sets the haunting tone for A Regular Guy. Like Jane's nightmare ride, the novel takes us through a landscape shadowed by sometimes menacing emotions and ambitions. A peculiar trip where we're guided only by the headlight beams of Simpson's luminous insights. The father Jane sets out to meet is Tom Owens, and he's anything but a regular guy. A New Age vegan composite of Bill Gates, Howard Hughes, and Charles Foster Kane, Owens, when he was just out of his teens, launched Genesis, a biotech company, and became fabulously rich. When Jane meets him, he's on the cusp of 30, and there's talk of him running for governor, even president someday. But Owens would never get the family values vote. He lives in the three habitable rooms of his 29-room mansion with his beautiful girlfriend, Olivia, a finalist, but by no means the hands-down winner of Owen's quest for a wife. Though he's erratically generous with friends and family, Owens also demonstrates a casual blindness to their presence. In the prologue of the novel, Jane recalls, "He was a man too busy to flush toilets." More than most people Jane had known, he was oblivious to the issuance from his body that might offend. He didn't believe in deodorant and often professed that with a proper diet and peppermint castile soap, you would neither perspire nor smell. About that last grammatically incorrect claim, I'm reminded of the apocryphal story about a sweating G.K. Chesterton who brushed past a man in an alley and heard him exclaim, "You smell." "No, sir," thundered Chesterton, "I stink. You smell." But hey, you can't expect proper grammar from a girl who spent years on a commune, cracking walnuts with her teeth and picking and eating the scabs off her knees. Part of the melancholy fascination of a regular guy arises from watching Jane transform from a magical wild child to an everyday eccentric adult. Equally engrossing are the doomed attempts of Jane, her mother, and Olivia to emotionally connect with Owens, even as he's sadly devolving from a wunderkind to a might-have-been. In A Regular Guy, Mona Simpson conducts a literary experiment that nearly rivals the ingeniousness of Owen's own initial biotech discovery. She clones an updated mad scientist tale onto a novel of manners. The result is a fictional life form so compelling and discerning, a reader can only hope that it also has the power to replicate itself.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Mona Simpson's new novel, A Regular Guy. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll be joined by Al Pacino. To get in the spirit, we'll close with a scene from The Godfather. Here's Pacino as a young Michael Corleone, still doing his best to distance himself from the family business. He's giving his fiancée a lesson in how the business works and how it's helped keep alive the career of the singer they're listening to.
Well, when Johnny was first starting out, he was signed to this personal service contract from the big band leader. And as his career got better and better, he wanted to get out of it. Now, Johnny is my father's godson. And my father went to see this band leader. And he offered him $10,000 to let Johnny go. But the band leader said no. So the next day, my father went to see him, only this time with Luca Brasi. And within an hour, he signed a release for a certified check of $1,000.
How did he do that?
My father made him an offer he couldn't refuse.
What was that?
Luca Brasi held a gun to his head, and my father assured him that either his brains or his signature would be on the contract. That's a true story. That's my family, Kate. It's not me.
Join us for an interview with Al Pacino tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Barbara Bogave. Alan, too, directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.